This is Marathon Training Academy, episode 238.
This episode is brought to you by Studio Sweden. Are you looking for new Bluetooth earphones that actually stay in your ears? They're sweatproof and have custom, comfortable wingtips while providing studio-quality sound with full sound transparency, so you'll always be aware of your surroundings while you run. You can go to studiosweden.com and use code MTA for 15% off today. That's SUDIOSWEDEN.com and use the code MTA15 for 15% off.
Welcome to the Marathon Training Academy podcast, where we empower you to run a marathon and change your life. I'm Trevor.
And I'm Angie.
In this episode, we talk with habit and productivity expert Gretchen Rubin about how your personality tendency relates to your running goals. And in the quick tip segment, Angie explains how to tell if you need an extra rest day during your training. And you can get expert help and support reaching your running goals. You can check out Academy membership when you visit our website, marathontrainingacademy.com. So, Angie, it's great to have Gretchen back on the podcast. She keeps cranking out the books, and I actually got to see her in person last summer at Podcast Movement in Anaheim, California. So got to take a quick picture with her and her sister, Elizabeth Kraft, who she co-hosts the podcast with. And I promptly texted you a photo so that you can be completely jealous that I got to meet her in person.
That was a cool opportunity.
So this is going to be a great episode, and I hope you guys enjoy our conversation with Gretchen. And people always love it when we have her on the show. Before we get into that, Angie, what is going on out there in MTA land? Any awesome things going on you can report about?
Yeah, definitely. We've got some great shout outs here. This note comes from Debbie in the Academy. She says, "Say hello to the newest member of the Ultra Marathon family. I ran the Urban Ultra 50K and was the second overall female, only a minute and a half behind the first place female who was 20 years younger than I was."
That's amazing.
"The heat kicked my butt, but I'm so happy to be done with this goal. I used the last part of the MTA 50K training plan to prepare. I'll be training for a 50 miler soon."
She just keeps graduating to bigger and bigger distances.
Yeah, I love it. This note comes from Ken. He says, "Hi, Angie and Trevor. Wanted to say thanks for your inspiring podcast. My wife and I ran the Carlsbad Marathon in Carlsbad, California. We both achieved PR finishes, aided by the great training tips. Your countless hours of information helped me during some dark moments during training. And today's finish had a few of those tougher moments."
Well, thank you, Ken, for that nice note. And I hear what you mean about darker moments during training. We all, I think, go through that.
And even during races, especially if you're going for a PR, you really have to dig deep.
Yeah, there's a lot of doubt that can creep in, especially, I don't know, when does that happen, between mile 20 and 26? So the struggle is real. Congrats, Ken, on persevering and earning a PR.
This note comes from Drew. He says, "Angie and Trevor, I ran my first half marathon yesterday in Chicago, and it was amazing. I set a goal of hitting a sub-2-hour time and ended up finishing with a time of 1 hour and 48 minutes. It just goes to show you that with some dedication, consistency, and some drive, you can achieve things you thought were impossible. I have what it takes to run a half marathon. Love the podcast. Keep them coming."
That's right, folks. All of you have what it takes to run a half marathon and change your life.
That's right.
That can be a life-changing distance, too. And you're right. Dedication makes the dream possible. You're living proof of it, man.
And this final one comes from Kelly. She posted this on her blog in response to our quick question on the last episode from the slower runner who was, you know, kind of feeling bad that her marathon time would be slow and, you know, how she felt about that.
Yeah, it was episode 236, the Jonathan Beverly interview. At the end, we had a quick tip where you answered a question from Maya, who calls herself a slower runner and was dealing with sort of a lot of angst about, you know, what it was going to be like on race day as a slower runner.
Yeah, that's right. So Kelly says, "I want to add my thoughts about being a slow runner. I'm definitely in that category. My best marathon was 5 hours and 16 minutes, with more being over 5 hours and 30 minutes for a total of 5 completed marathons. One of my biggest frustrations is finishing the marathon and they have run out of things like ice cream sandwiches. This is my reward. But not only ice cream sandwiches, I have seen them be low or out of water and out of other foods. I fully believe that those who are out there over 5 hours are the real winners. They're the ones who need those little pick-me-ups the most. It takes a lot of endurance to be on your feet that long. Think about it. A lot of runners have already had their showers and are headed to lunch while we're still out there running or walking. I started running at age 49 with the goal of completing a marathon by age 50. I did that one and four more. I do not have the younger version of myself to compare to this age. I started with the goal to finish a marathon just because I happened to see runners in a marathon one day. My goal now is to run a faster marathon when I'm 60 than I did at 50. I really enjoyed listening to this podcast during my runs, and Kelly says thank you. And we, of course, love to hear from people who post on our blog.
Yeah, I'm glad that resonated with you, Kelly, and there's definitely lots of runners who feel the same way. We've heard from lots of back-of-the-pack runners who can testify that it really sucks to get to the end of a race and all the good food has been picked over.
That's right.
And we know how you feel about those ice cream sandwiches, Andrew. Remember those races? We've been to a couple of races that give out ice cream sandwiches. Hits the spot.
And I remember missing them, and I was, you know, only finished like a little over 4 hours, so... Anyway, yes, I agree. I really like the races that actually give out the bags of food or the box of food so that everyone ends up getting the same thing and they don't run out.
Yeah.
So.
Well, no matter what your running pace is, we are here to help you stay inspired and motivated to train. And part of that is just knowing yourself better. And that's what this episode is going to be all about. We do have a quick announcement. We are partnering up with a race in Florida, in Gainesville, Florida. And we always love to partner with races. So we'd like to take a minute and tell you about the 5 Points of Life race weekend in Gainesville, Florida. So listen up, all you folks that want to get to sunny Florida to run a race in February. I know, so this is not much time.
Or you can put it on the calendar for 2019 as well.
That's true. So the 5 Points of Life race weekend is February 17th to the 18th. They're going to have a marathon, a half marathon, and a 5K in beautiful Gainesville, Florida, which is home of the University of Florida. Think Florida Gators. Usually the race temps are around 58 degrees.
Sounds perfect.
And the marathon is a Boston qualifier, and it's a nonprofit race that goes to support the 5 Points of Life Foundation, which supports blood centers in the area. Angie, I know that you give blood every year. You have some sort of rare blood type. You're some sort of mutant, aren't you?
No, I don't.
Call you up and they're like, hey, we need your blood.
I think they do that to anyone who's ever donated before. Yes, we're definitely a big fan of blood donation and, of course, organ and tissue donation. And the foundation educates and raises awareness of the 5 ways to share life with others through the donation of blood, apheresis, marrow, cord blood, organs, and tissue. And so, of course, for a very reasonable entry fee to the race, you get a weekend-long celebration of running, complete with a multi-vendor expo, unique Gator-themed t-shirt, and a chance for both prize money for top finishers and great raffle prizes.
And this is Gainesville's only marathon. It has a picturesque course which winds through town and the university campus. And you may see live gators, which some people might not want to go for that reason, but I would love to see some live gators along the marathon course, wouldn't you, Angie?
It might be a good motivation to run fast.
To register for the race, visit 5pointsoflife.com. They are funded in part by Visit Gainesville, Alachua County. Once again, that's 5pointsoflife.com to learn more about the 5 Points of Life race weekend on February 17th to the 18th in beautiful Gainesville, Florida. Well, now we're going to get into our conversation with Gretchen Rubin, author of the book The 4 Tendencies and many other great books like The Happiness Project. This is actually the third time we've had her on the show. We'd like to have her on at the beginning of the year because, you know, we've made resolutions as runners. We're probably a lot of us are in the thick of training for our spring marathons. There's a lot of commitments that have been made. So it's always nice to have someone on the podcast who can talk about how to make habits stick.
That's right, because research shows that often by the beginning of February, a great majority of people have given up on their New Year's resolutions or goals. So knowing yourself better, learning what your core tendency is, can help you manage those inner and outer expectations so that you can be healthier, happier, and more productive, which is, you know, what we all want.
That's right. A little bio on Gretchen. She actually studied law and clerked for Supreme Court Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, but realized that she wanted to be a writer instead and has written some blockbuster bestsellers. She mentions that she's best known for The Happiness Project, which has sold almost 3 million copies. She's been interviewed by Oprah. She's got a very highly viewed TED Talk. This lady is killing it, and it's an honor to have her on the show. So, hope you guys learn a lot. Let's go ahead and get our conversation with Gretchen Rubin.
Well on my way, well on my way.
All right, we're on the podcast now with Gretchen Rubin, author of the book, The 4 Tendencies, and many other great books, which Angie has read over and over. And I have too. Excellent. Gretchen, great to have you back on the MTA podcast.
It's great to talk to you again.
Well, thanks for sending us a copy of The Four Tendencies. When we read your book, Better Than Before, that was like the part of the book that I enjoyed the most. So when I saw that you had a whole book coming out on just The Four Tendencies, I was really excited.
Yeah, I think a lot of people who read Better Than Before, which is all about habit change, the 21 strategies to make or break habits, a lot of them were like, wait a minute, I want to hear a little bit more about this framework. But I just couldn't fit it all into the book because I had to cover all of habit change. Yeah, so that's what led me to write The Four Tendencies, exactly that.
So how did you come up with the idea of The Four Tendencies specifically? Was there kind of a moment that it just hit you, or was it a gradual process?
Well, it was sort of both, because as I was thinking about Better Than Before and trying to understand patterns about when people could or couldn't successfully change their habits, I was very struck by different things that people said that for whatever reason didn't ring true for me, or I didn't really understand. Like, and one of the most important conversations was when a friend said to me, I don't understand, because when I was in high school, I was on the track team and I never missed track practice. So why can't I go running now? And I thought, well, why not? Because it's the same person. It's the same behavior. At one time it was effortless. Now she can't do it. So I was seeing patterns like that and trying to make sense of them, but I didn't really understand how they all fit together until one day. So that was the gradual part. And then the epiphany part was I was sitting at my desk right where I am right this second. And I was looking at my to-do list, and all of a sudden, the word expectation just like came into my mind. And I realized that we all face two kinds of expectations: outer expectations, like a work deadline or a request from a spouse, and then also inner expectations, like our own desire to keep a New Year's resolution, our own desire to, get back into practicing guitar. And when I realized that it was expectations, I started seeing that how people responded to outer and inner expectation determined how all these patterns fit together. And so that was this huge moment of realization for me.
So what was going on with your friend?
So my friend was an obliger, I now know. So there's upholders, questioners, obligers, and rebels. And now if my friend said that, I'd be like, oh, well, you're clearly an obliger, which means you readily meet outer expectations, but you struggle to meet inner expectations. And so I'm sure you know this pattern well. It's like the biggest group. This is the tendency that the largest number of people belong to, for both men and women. And so this is somebody who doesn't have trouble showing up when a team or a coach is waiting, or when a trainer is waiting, or when a friend is waiting who's going to work out with you, or when you're thinking about your duty to be a role model for somebody else who you really want to exercise. Those outer expectations that person will meet. But when it's just their own desire to do it, like, oh, I should really do that. I need to make time for myself and do that. I need to get more motivated and do this. Those inner expectations are a challenge. So she's an obliger.
Other things crowded out because they haven't been accountable to someone else, or?
Well, it's interesting because obligers will often use language like it's crowded out, or there's no time for me, or I put others first. To me, it's like, it's not like that. It's not like who's first in line. It's outer accountability versus inner accountability. So like a different form that this takes is somebody who says like, well, of course I have no time to exercise because I'm a doctor who gives 110% to my patients. I'm always there for my patients. I'm at the hospital all the time. I have no time to go to the gym. That's also obliger, because it's saying I'm meeting outer expectations, those of my patients, but not meeting my inner expectation. So the answer is not to create more time. The answer is to create more accountability.
Very interesting.
Which works for obligers, but not for other tendencies necessarily.
not necessarily. Exactly. Sometimes accountability works for other tendencies, especially for questioners and upholders. Often accountability can backfire on rebels. Rebels like want to feel free to do whatever they want to do in their own way, in their own time. They resist both outer and inner expectations. So sometimes if you try to give accountability to a rebel, it will actually make them less likely to follow through with something. They don't like the idea that someone's telling, what do you mean I'm supposed to show up at 10 a.m. on a Saturday morning to an exercise class? I hate feeling trapped like that. I'm not going to go. I don't care if the teacher's waiting for me. That annoys me. So for them, accountability could actually be counterproductive.
And I think I've heard you point out before that the rebel is the smallest tendency.
It is. That's exactly right. That's the one the fewest people belong to. And then only slightly larger than Rebel is Upholder. And Upholders are those who readily meet outer and inner expectations. So Upholders and Rebels are the opposite of each other. And you're exactly right. They're the smaller of the tendencies.
And somehow Angie and I managed to get together.
Oh, and now what are you? What are your tendencies?
I'm the Upholder and Trevor's the Rebel. So,
ooh, now that's a tricky combo.
And then we try running a business together. It's just really interesting.
I actually was just reading the Rebel chapter again today.
Which is the largest chapter in the book.
It is. The smallest tendency and the longest chapter.
And you just nailed it. I mean, what you describe in the book is pretty much the setup we have. I have a lot of the vision and ideas for the business, and I can just give Angie those agenda items, and she's really good at implementing and following through.
But
she's
in advance. He likes to have these spur-of-the-moment ideas, and I'm like, no, no, no. You just don't decide we're doing a video in 5 minutes. You have to, like, prep me for that.
Yeah.
Right, because they like spontaneity. Rebels, like, when they're ready to go, yeah. It's like, let's go.
And yeah. Upholders yeah. really like the you know, more of just the schedule and everything and knowing
yeah.
what you're...
I've learned a lot of things the hard way.
Now, usually when Rebels are paired up, either in romance or in work or in both, as in your case, usually when Rebels are paired up, they're paired up with obliger. So are you sure you're an upholder and not an obliger? Because that's unusual to have an upholder
yeah.
and a Rebel paired up.
I'm quite sure. I'm actually an upholder who tips towards questioner. So,
okay.
I do really give some pushback. And yeah, I definitely don't jump through the hoops that...
she has no problem meeting inner expectations. I mean, follows a marathon training plan to the T. Right. Every single workout.
If I decide I'm going to meditate, I meditated every day last year. So
sure, interesting. And so, do you ever get frustrated though with typically with a Rebel? Not always, because Rebels can be super ambitious and very idealistic and really value being considerate partners, and so it doesn't come up as much. But sometimes upholders get exasperated with Rebels because they feel like they can't, sometimes the Rebels change the rules on them. Like, we're going to do this. No, I've changed everything. Like, we're going to do it this other way. Or maybe a Rebel, like, there's something where you're like, I'll do this and you do that. And the Rebel's like, yeah, I'm not going to do that. Do you ever run into conflicts like that?
That never happens.
It definitely, we have a lot of frustrations. I mean, one of the things is he likes to just kind of like float all his ideas out there like he's going to do them. Like, oh, kids, let's go to the beach this weekend. You know, we should do this. We should do this, this, and this. So my upholder brain is thinking, okay, we need to make plans to go to the beach. Let's, what are we going to do? And the kids are like, when are we leaving? And then, you know,
and
on Saturday,
just,
he's like,
yeah.
No, I don't want to go to the beach.
I was just feeling out the mood of the room.
Yeah. So there's things like that. But, you know, your book has been so helpful and, you know, even reading Better Than Before as well, where you brought up this concept. Because I used to think that he was purposely doing things to just make my life more difficult. I didn't realize, you know, I thought like everyone should be an upholder in training. Like they should be finding their upholderness. I didn't realize that people approach the world in totally different or expectations in totally different ways. So it's actually helped our marriage a lot. I think we've probably relaxed a lot towards each other knowing that we're just different.
Right. No. And I mean, and I think you've put your finger on, I think, what is kind of one of the most important points, which is it's not that I'm right and you're wrong or that you're right and I'm wrong. It's that we both see things in a different way. And so rather than try to change each other or feel guilty or bad about the way we are, we should just say, OK, well, given that you like to be spontaneous and I like to make a plan, how do we set things up in a way that we both feel comfortable about it? Because once we understand that that's the issue, then we don't have to take it personally. It's just a challenge to be solved. It's not that somebody needs to change or that somebody is doing something the wrong way. And I think that's hard because it's just, at least for me, it's hard to remember that other people see the world differently or that other people don't. You know, to me, I'm like, what could be more obvious than writing a to-do list? Like, how is this? But I've learned many people, like, it doesn't work for them. And it's like, there's no magic to the to-do list. If it doesn't work for you, then it's not a good tool for you. Like, the fact that I find it a useful tool doesn't mean that it works for everyone. So, yeah, there's a lot of empathy, I think, and lack of judgment that can come once you understand the tendencies.
Yeah, definitely. Now, we just mentioned questioner really quick in passing. That's the fourth tendency that we haven't talked about. So tell us what questioners are like.
So I'm married to a questioner myself. So speaking of married couples, so questioners question all expectations. They'll do something if they think it makes sense. So essentially they reject outer expectations and make everything an inner expectation, because if it meets their inner standard, they will do it no problem. if it fails their standard, then they will resist. And so typically they argue against anything they consider arbitrary or irrational or inefficient. So they always want to know why. So if you tell a questioner to do something, their first question is always, why should I? You know, why should I listen to you? Why am I doing this at all? Why should I be doing this? And so that's questioner. And questioner, obliger is the largest tendency, and then behind them is questioner.
Our 11-year-old son is a questioner, and he's the only one of our kids I've been able to pinpoint clearly because they're still developing, but he's been a questioner. I could probably, you know, if I would have known about this when he was two, I would have been able to tell.
Yeah.
So it's been helpful having this framework, even in dealing with him, not to say there still aren't frustrations, but just to knowing that's how, the way he looks at the world.
If something's not fair in his mind, Boy, he gets really been out of shape.
Well, and you know, one of the things I would sort of caution you, because I've heard from so many questioners that this is an issue, is a lot of questioners get in trouble at school. They also get in similar trouble at work later, but they get in trouble with school because teachers might think that they're sassy or disrespectful because they're like, well, why should I? Or maybe they'll do really well on a test, but they're not going to write the book report or they're not going to, you know, do some assignment. But if you ask them what's going on in their mind is, well, I'll study for the test because I know I should learn, but I'm not going to write this dumb book report because it's a big waste of my time. And so a lot of times with questioners, if you take the time to say, well, I understand that you think that this is a waste of your time, but let me explain to you why it is that we ask our fourth graders to do this. I want you to understand like the logic behind it. Then they're like, okay, like I didn't get that. And I've heard from so many questioners where they're like, if somebody had just told me why I wanted to learn to read, I would have done it, but I just thought it just seemed like this arbitrary, weird thing. Like, who cares? And then they won't, you know, and they can really stick to their guns often. And so, and this happens with adult questioners too, where if you get a thin-skinned boss who's like, I don't like the way you're questioning my judgment. You're always undermining my authority. I don't understand like why you can't just get with the program. We got the memo from corporate. Hey, I don't need to have a long explanation with you. Well, then that questioner can seem like disrespectful. Where again, once you understand that this is just how questioners are, it's just like give them the robust explanations they need and they'll get on board, no problem.
So if people haven't pinpointed themselves from our little conversation here, how can they go and figure out their tendency?
So I have a quiz on my site, GretchenRubin.com, and 1.3 million people now have taken this quiz.
That's awesome.
So it will spit out an answer for you. And so it's how you respond to outer expectations and inner expectations. And the combination of whether you meet or resist it, that's what determines whether you're an upholder, a questioner, an obliger, or a rebel.
So let's bring it back to runners. When people are going to train for a marathon, they'll go and they'll download a marathon training plan, which could be between 16 to 20 weeks long with a prescribed workout almost every day of the week. So can you walk us through the four tendencies and how like each tendency could best, you know, get themselves to follow that plan?
Or best safely train for a marathon.
Right. Absolutely. And I think this is exactly the kind of example where you can see how the four tendencies could come into play. So for an upholder, something like that is very satisfying and very easy to follow, as you probably have experienced as an upholder.
Check those boxes off.
Yeah, it's like very fulfilling. It's very satisfying because you know exactly what's expected of you. You just can do it. Like you made up your mind to do it. You're going to do it. There's a lot of gratification coming from like day after day. I'm just doing it. It's very reassuring. And in fact, what you might see with an upholder is tightening, which is when an upholder feels immense pressure to do it. And so it's very, like if they felt sick and everybody would be like, you should take the day off. They might be like, no, I just don't feel right. I need to make myself exercise because I don't feel good about the fact that I'm letting myself down. And so if you're an upholder, you want to be aware of the fact that you might feel this tremendous pressure to do it and to always say to yourself, but look, if what I really want to do is run the marathon, I'm not going to do myself any favors now. In the long run, I'm going to let myself down more if I exercise with an injury or when I'm sick or I push myself so hard that I can't fulfill it. So, you know, you want to remember that as an upholder.
I'm glad you said that because overtraining is the number one cause of injury.
And I think we've heard from people who maybe are upholders, you know, they do a long run, let's say on Saturday, and they don't think it goes very well. So they want to repeat it the next day.
Yes.
Like, I know I can do this better. I know I can put this effort and hit that required pace. I'm going to do it the next day. It's like, no.
Yeah. So with upholders, you definitely want to remind them why they wouldn't want to overdo something because their tendency, because they can make themselves do it. So Now, for questioners, it's interesting. Now, one of the things that's interesting about questioners, they always want to know why. So they're going to have a better adherence if they understand, like, oh, I understand, like, short versus long, and this is why you do this, and this is why you do that, and this is why you do that, you know, hills, and, you know, and the more they understand why things are the way they are, the more effortlessly they're going to follow through. Because if they feel like it's arbitrary that I'm doing 12 miles a day, then that's going to seem illegitimate to them. Mm-hmm. So everything needs to be justified. Here's the other thing about questioners. They tend to love data. So they love monitoring. So they might really like to have, you know, trackers and logs and, you know, really what, you know, all kinds of things, because they tend to really like to know information about themselves. But they also love to customize. They like to make tweak things to make it better for them. So one message you could have is like, this is our program. We feel like it's the best possible program. This is why we have it this way. But of course, you know your body the best. If you see that, like, it works better for you to do this or this or this, like, you know your best. Like, we want you to do this in the way that's best for you, because they like that feeling of customization. And typically they'll do it anyway. But so if there's ways that are like better or worse to customize, you might point that out. You might say, like, you know, we found that, you know, if you alter it by 2 miles or something, like, that's totally great. But once we see people really swinging, then you're really going to undermine the purpose of this training method or whatever. You know, you want to tell them why they might not want to customize if they shouldn't.
So with a questioner, would a weakness be like they have maybe a decision paralysis because they ask so many questions, they can't decide on a plan because what is the best one out there? There's hundreds, you know?
I'm so glad you brought that up. That is analysis paralysis. And this is when questioners can't move forward with a decision because they're like, I don't know what the best information is. I don't know what the right choice is. And so one of the things you can do if you're a questioner and you're falling into this is you could say, like, it's not efficient for me to keep researching past Friday. You know, if I want to run the marathon this year, I need to get onto it by the beginning of the month. So I'm going to make my best guess. Or you can use a trusted authority. You could say, you know, I'm going to read this magazine. I'm going to look at this website. I'm going to talk to this friend. I'm going to go into this running store where, like, all the clerks are super, super into running. I can be guided by their judgment. I'm going to do my own research, but I'm going to be very guided by what they tell me. I don't have to recreate the wheel. I can use trusted authority. Let's give yourself limits. Say, I'm going to investigate the top four rated methods and take a look at them, but I'm not going to look at the top 20 rated. I'm going to, like, limit it. So that's things. So excellent point. Analysis paralysis is something that questioners face.
And since questioners love efficiency, I loved how you use that word sort of to remind the questioner to, you know, get on the ball with it.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, you want to always appeal to the core value of the tendency.
Yeah.
So for upholder, that is discipline and execution. If you are over disciplined, you will not be able to fulfill. You will not be able to execute on your aim. Questioner, it's efficiency and justification. Why are you doing this? Is this the best way to do it? Obliger is outer accountability. So the idea that they're going to, like, just do it on their own. No, it's like, have a group, have a Facebook page, work out with a trainer, think of your duty to be a role model to somebody else. Like, I want to show my children what it means to make a big goal and follow through with it over time. Like, I need to show them that I can do this. I can keep my promises to myself. I have a commitment to health and to, you know, pushing myself. And if they see that I drift away from this, they're going to feel like, well, they can quit basketball. They can decide not to do the science fair after all. I need to model that for them. So there's a million ways to create outer accountability. And that's what obligers need. So, you know, any kind of feeling accountable to somebody else, that somebody else is watching, somebody else is paying attention, is what is going to work for obligers.
It reminds me of a runner just the other day was talking about doing a 50K and raising money. I think she was raising $10 per mile. Because when you're out there actually on the course on race day, knowing that people have given money and sort of each mile is dedicated, you're more likely to stick with the goal. That could be, you know, how an obliger could hack it.
Yes. That is a fantastic suggestion, because it's like, I really deeply committed to this philanthropy, and they're just not going to get their money if I let them down. And so it's not just me running for myself, it's me running for others. And that's really important. Yes, absolutely. That's a great form of accountability. And then finally, rebels could do anything they want to do. You know, they can, and they might love a challenge. So for rebel, it might be something like, well, I'm not going to go exercise at a gym every day. I mean, what? That's so boring. But my friends think I can't run a marathon in 2018. Watch me. You know, like, that's exciting. That's big. That's challenging. or they might really identify. I've always been a runner. I'm an athlete. Like, I don't stay trapped behind a desk and under the fluorescent lights. I go for these long runs. I love seeing nature. I love pushing my body. I love seeing what I can do. I love blowing other people away. That's my identity. That's who I am. So, of course, I can do these runs because that's at the core of who I am.
And as a rebel myself, I found to make myself get out there and run, I kind of have to remind myself of my identity, that I'm the kind of guy that runs marathons. I have this ideal version of myself in my brain where I'm, you know, running on trails over the mountain. Yeah. So like I'm like calling myself back to my identity that has some sort of freedom element to it. You know, I'm free to go out and run this trail race, yeah, or, you know, do these marathons.
And you often turn a lot of your runs into like mini adventures. Like he's not content to do the same route day after day, you know, like an upholder might be. So he wants to go have this an adventure and make that part of it too. So
that's great advice. So the identity of I'm strong, I'm athletic, I'm free, I'm unchained, I'm having adventures, I'm out in nature. I've heard of rebels who are like, I know a rebel who I exercise regularly. And I was like, how do you do that? And she said, I exercise during the day when I'm supposed to be working. So she had a feeling of like, oh, I'm, you know, I'm like sneaking it. That, you mean, but this idea of, but for rebels, it is this idea of freedom and authenticity. I'm free to do whatever I want. And I'm putting my authentic self out into the world. And a lot of times they can do things in order to live up to their authentic self. Because what, and like I know somebody who did this with a child playing piano. You know, you don't say your teacher says you have to practice. I say you have to practice. We're going to make a sticker chart. You'll earn such and such thing if you practice. That's not interesting to a rebel. But the mother said, oh, my goodness, I saw that super challenging piece of music that your music teacher gave to you. I don't think many 10-year-olds could play something like that. I hope I get the chance to see you up on stage performing that because you're such a beautiful performer. Yes, I am a performer. I have a challenge. And also, what does it mean to be a performer? A performer must practice. That is the identity of a performer, is the perfect execution, blowing people away with what I can do. And so that's a way to appeal to these rebel values. Whereas, you know, upholders like you and me might be like, the teacher said you have to do it. How is this not written in stone? You know, or like, you said you were going to practice. Why aren't you keeping your promise to yourself? Or the questioner, like, well, if I practice half an hour every day, I'll get, you know. But the rebel, it's got to be like, this is what you want. This is what you choose. This is the kind of person you are.
I wonder if we could illustrate this again with eating and food, because a lot of our listeners have made resolutions to cut out junk food, sugar, carbs, perhaps, to eat healthier in 2018. Yeah. So can you walk us through how the tendency speaks to that?
Well, first of all, I want to make the point, because a lot of people are confused about this, is that if you want to lose weight, not just eat more healthily, but you actually want to lose weight, you do not lose weight through exercise. That is not an effective way to lose weight. So if you are trying to lose weight, you really want to go on the eating side of it. That the research is overwhelming. So, but then, yeah, but even, you know, there's a lot of people, reason why people want to eat more healthily. So upholders, it's really about getting clarity. What is it that you're expecting of yourself? So don't just say, I'm going to eat healthier. You know, it's like, what does that look like? That could be, I'm going to quit sugar. I'm going to give up carbs. I'm going to bring a lunch from home every day. I'm going to cook 5 nights a week instead of ordering fast food, whatever it would be. Be very clear with what your expectations are for yourself. For questioners, it's like, really get clear. Why are you eating the way you are? You know, I eat very low carb. So I'm like one of these low carb, high fat people. I really believe in that. And my father's a questioner. And like, I told him about it and he read a bunch of books and he's constantly reading research about it. And he's just like, oh, it's so clear. This is the best, healthiest way to eat. He so deeply believes in this is the way that then his actions follow. So whatever you're going to do, like if, as a questioner, you want to really give yourself assurances. This is the best way. I talked to a woman who wanted to work with a nutritionist and she interviewed 10 nutritionists and had an Excel spreadsheet that rated them all on a scale of 1 to 10 across 8 dimensions. I'm like, okay, that is questioner. But then she really trusted the authority of the person that she ultimately worked with. And so she felt like I can really follow this person's advice because I've really assured myself that this is the most efficient, the most well thought through, the best research, the most customized way for me to eat. Obliger is all about the outer accountability. So it's like Make a deal with a friend. Remind yourself that if you eat healthier, the other people in your life are going to eat healthier. You might commit to others. Like my sister's a type 1 diabetic and she works in Hollywood, so she's constantly changing workplaces. And the first thing she does when she walks in is she says to people, I'm a type 1 diabetic. I'm not eating any of the food that's in the kitchen. I'm bringing my own snacks. You know, you will see me do this, because she wants to have the feeling like, you know, or people saying like, oh, Liz, I thought you said you were type 1 diabetic, but I just saw you eat 3 donuts. Like she knows, she wants that feeling that people are watching. She invokes that. Hmm. Now, some people might not like that feeling, but she likes that. Or you might make a deal with somebody. I heard of one obliger who was like, if I eat dessert, my husband eats 2 desserts.
Ooh.
He was like, that works for me. But she's like, I don't want my husband eating 2 desserts every night, you know, because it's not healthy for him. So she might have done it. She might have eaten dessert herself, even though that was her good habit, but she's not going to impose it on her husband. So there's a lot of different ways you can do that. And then for rebels, again, it's choice, it's freedom. So a lot of times they don't like being addicted or chained. So sometimes messages to themselves, things like, you know what, these big food companies, they think they can addict me to their sugar and their processed chemicals with their fancy marketing and their low prices and their crinkly packages. But I'm free. I'm not addicted to sugar. I'm not chained to junk food. Like, I like healthy organic food. I like going to the farmer's market. I like experimenting with new flavors and international cuisine. Like, I'm going to make my own thing. I'm not going to eat what they tell me to eat. But then also there's other ways of tying it to freedom. I heard of a rebel who said, I really wanted to lose weight, but every time I tried to tell myself that I couldn't eat something, I would rebel against it. Very common for rebels. And she said, but then I realized that part of my rebel identity is I love adventure. I love to travel, but I wasn't traveling very much because I feel really uncomfortable in airplanes because of my weight. And I realized if I ate differently, I would feel more comfortable in airplanes. And that's the way that I'm going to live up to my rebel identity of freedom and adventure, because then I'll feel more free to fly. And I was like, well, that's really smart, because she's not doing it because she's supposed to, or because the doctor tells her to, or because society expects it. She's like, no, I want to feel good on an airplane because I'm going to Rome or I'm going to Thailand, you know. And it's like, okay, that is what caught her imagination. That's how she can do what she wants for her own reasons.
Yeah, I love it.
Yeah. I think if I were you, Gretchen, I would be kind of analyzing everyone that I knew in my life, and like people in pop culture too.
I do it all the time.
Angie mentioned the other day that you are a fan of The Office, and we are rewatching that on Netflix.
We love Office.
I love The Office.
Have you pegged any of the characters?
Yeah. What do you think Michael is?
I think
obliger.
Obliger. I think he's an obliger. You know, do you guys ever watch the show Parks and Rec?
We didn't.
Just a couple episodes.
Yeah, we just started.
It's created by a lot of, it sort of has very much the same vibe. In the Parks and Rec, you can really see it. It's not that's obvious in the Office. I feel like it's not as obvious. Mm-hmm. There don't seem to be the same. I mean, I don't feel like they are that strong. I think Pam's an obliger.
Yeah.
And I think you see that she does have the obliger rebellion, which is when she finally kind of snaps and does the fire walking and tells Jim how she really feels and breaks it off with Roy. But you know, but for a long time she's just sort of going along with what people expect of her, and she's feeling under a lot of strain because of that.
I was thinking Creed might be a rebel because he just like marches to the beat of his own drum, you know. He's just
I think Creed is a rebel. That is a good call.
That's what Angie thinks all rebels are like, I guess.
My favorite Creed line is, I've been in a cult both as a follower and as a leader. You may have more fun as a follower, but you make more money as a leader. I mean, clearly, like, he doesn't know what his job title is. He gets somebody. I mean, yeah, I think he's a rebel. He's just doing whatever he wants. Yeah.
He's what about Dwight? I kind of see him more as an upholder because he's just like so like
by the book.
Yeah. But he could also be a questioner, maybe, but, you know, because he's always like, well, I should be manager. Why am I not manager? But then he goes follow the program pretty well. So maybe he is an upholder. Yeah. Well, it's funny. One of the things people often do with pop culture is they try to get me to say which of the houses of Hogwarts correspond to the 4 tendencies. Mm-hmm. And the fact is, I flatly deny that that is possible, because you have Hermione and Fred and George in the same house. Mm-hmm. They can be Gryffindor for sure, but they cannot be in the same tendency, because Hermione is not the same tendency as Fred and George, who I think are questioners who tip to rebel, you know, and they're constantly struggling with each other. Hermione drives the twins crazy and they drive her crazy.
And she's like an upholder.
I think she's probably the most famous upholder in popular culture right now. Like, if I had to say, like, who's somebody that everybody knows, I would say it's Hermione. Yeah.
You could have named your book the Personality Sorting Hat.
That's a line in the book. It's a Muggle Sorting Hat.
Or the Tendency Sorting Hat, yeah. Because, you know, one thing to point out is that this explains, you know, how people respond to expectations. It doesn't explain if someone's an introvert or extrovert or a morning or night person, you know. And I think that's kind of a question that people have. They try to, like, narrow everyone into a box. But like you said, you know, we're all different and we express this differently depending on a lot of other aspects of our personality.
And the word tendency, you know, also, it's not like you're like this 100% of the time, but you tend to be like this.
Yeah. No, I think that's a super important point because you're exactly right. A lot of times people sort of build a whole picture in their mind, like a rebel is creative and innovative or a jerk or narcissistic or, you know, obligers or people pleasers or doormats or, you know, and I'm like, no, there are people pleaser obligers and then there are obligers who really don't care what anybody thinks. There are very ambitious and driven upholders. There's also slacker upholders. As you say, it doesn't tell you whether you're introverted or extroverted or how ambitious you are or how analytical you are or how creative you are or how considerate of other people's feelings you are, or how idealistic you are. But you can see if you have a very ambitious, idealistic, considerate rebel, they're going to express that rebel tendency in a very different way from somebody who's a rebel, who's not very ambitious, doesn't really care about other people's feelings, you know, and isn't really that interested in the world. Like that rebel tendency is going to come out in a different way. It's going to look different, but they're going to have the same core inclination, which if somebody asks or tells them to do something, they're going to resist. Same thing with questioners. You can have 50 questioners and they're all going to be different, except if you ask or tell them to do something, they will all look at you and as one, they will say, why should I? Because that's what it is to be a questioner, is to say, well, why should I? But you're right. It doesn't tell you much about a person. You know, people have this kind of idea of obliger, and then I'm like, Andre Agassi is an obliger, 100% textbook obliger. So wrap your mind around that. Yeah. You know, he's 100% obliger, but he doesn't fit, I think, what a lot of people are conjuring in their mind.
Another question you probably get commonly is that people peg one tendency in their mind as like the ideal tendency. And they think, well, can I change my tendency? Can I work towards that? And that's probably a fallacy, as instead of just maximizing who they are.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, can you change your inborn nature? I don't think so. But even if you could, it would be hugely difficult. So it's just like, just to me, it's like all of these tendencies have strengths and weaknesses. And so the thing is to harness the strengths of your tendency and then figure out strategies to offset any weakness or limitation that you're experiencing. So if you're an obliger, so a lot of times obligers are like, I want to be an upholder. I'm like, just give yourself outer accountability and then you will look exactly like every upholder out there, because all you need is the outer accountability and you'll get there. Or like a rebel's like, well, I want to get myself to follow through with things. I'm like, you can follow through with things, but you have to do it in a rebel way, because you've got to harness the power of the rebel tendency. Don't try to use a to-do list if that doesn't work for you. Don't try to put things on the calendar if you just rebel against it. Find the way for you to do it in your way. There's a million ways that other rebels have come up to deal with these challenges, which are kind of inherent in the rebel tendency. Pick the easy, simple way. Just work around it and get where you want to go, rather than trying to change your inborn nature. Because, like, you're fine. Whatever you are, there's a lot of people who are just like you in that way. They've all come up with a lot of solutions. It's just like, learn from them and figure it out.
Awesome. Where people need to go to find you and connect with you online?
A lot of different ways. So you can go to my website, GretchenRubin.com. There's tons of resources there. The quiz that we talked about, if you want to find out if you're an upholder, a questioner, an obliger, a rebel. I have my podcast, which I do once a week, called Happier with Gretchen Rubin, where I talk to my sister, Elizabeth Kraft, about how to be happier, healthier, more productive, more creative. My books, we've been talking about the four tendencies. If you're interested in habit change generally, we were also talking about my book Better Than Before. I'm probably still best known for my book, The Happiness Project.
It's one of my favorites, for sure.
Thank you. That's so nice to hear. And I'm all over, you know, Twitter and Facebook and Instagram as Gretchen Rubin. And I love to engage with listeners and viewers and readers in all different ways. So if you have questions, illustrations, observations, I love to hear from people.
Well, thank you so much, Gretchen.
Yeah, this has been so helpful.
Oh, it's so much fun to talk to you. A rare spotting of a rebel upholder.
Almost great. 15 years and going strong.
There you go. Excellent. Well, so much fun to talk to you again.
You
Thanks
too.
For having me.
Thank you, Gretchen. Have a great day.
All right. Well, I hope you guys enjoyed that conversation with Gretchen Rubin. I definitely encourage you to go take the four tendencies test over on our website so you can you know yourself better. And like you heard in the conversation, it's all about how you manage expectations, both inner and outer expectations. Angie, sometimes I wish I wasn't a upholder like you. I think sometimes getting my runs in would be easier, you know? So be glad for your upholderness. All you have to do is decide you're going to get something done, and then you have this solid inner expectation of what you're going to do, and you follow through.
That's true, but I'll never be called the life of the party, so... because my rigid schedule dictates that I be asleep by 10:30 at night.
That is true.
So like Gretchen was saying, every tendency comes with positive points and negative points. So the key is to manage those things so that you can become the happiest and most productive version of yourself possible.
Now, you've coached a lot of runners through the years. Have you been able to use some of these, like deploy some of these tools in your coaching?
You know, when I first started coaching, I had no idea about the different tendencies. And so it was a real light bulb moment, like we talked about in the interview, not only in our marriage, but also in the runners that I coach. And I could definitely see the people who were clearly upholders and those who asked me a ton of questions or questioners.
They can be kind of high maintenance sometimes, don't you think, the questioners?
Yeah, something because they really need to dig in and find the answers to everything and really have things explained to them very clearly. And then, of course, the obligers, you know, really needed to find those sources of outer accountability to be successful. And honestly, you know, not too many rebels signed up. If they did, I probably never heard from them, or they just did their own thing. So
you design their training block, send it to them, and then they just do their own thing.
And then I wouldn't hear from them for like 2 months.
But they're still paying you.
Right.
Well, whatever works, you know, maybe that worked for them.
That's right. So yeah, like she said, there is no one best tendency and there's no wrong tendency. It's just all about learning how to manage how you are.
Well, now it's time for this episode's quick tip. Angie's going to talk about how to know if you should take an extra rest day during your training or just push through. Before we get into that, we'd like to thank this episode's sponsor, RX Bar. RX Bar is a whole food protein bar made with a few simple, clean ingredients and no BS.
Yeah, they're perfect on the go. You can keep one in your office if you have to miss lunch or need an afternoon snack and don't want to hit the vending machines. You can throw them in your bag or purse. And the best thing is, of course, besides them being very healthy, is that they're delicious. They have 11 flavor varieties, all which are gluten-free, soy-free, dairy-free, and free of any added sugars. They have no artificial colors and flavors or preservatives or fillers, so you can actually taste the real ingredients.
So for 25% off your first order, visit rxbar.com/MTA. Enter the promo code MTA at checkout. That's rxbar.com/MTA and use the promo code MTA for 25% off your first order. We'd also like to thank Health IQ for sponsoring this episode. They use science and data to secure lower rates on life insurance for health-conscious people like runners. Just like saving money on car insurance for being a good driver, if you live a healthy lifestyle, you should be able to save money on your life insurance. That's why it pays to see what Health IQ can do for you.
You can see if you can qualify for up to a 33% savings by using one or more of the following methods. You can take one of the Health IQ quizzes. You can use a screenshot from an activity tracker like Strava, Runkeeper, Nike, Garmin, MapMyRun, things like that. For running, if you run at least 10 miles per week or cycle at least 50 miles per week, you may qualify. Or you can use a screenshot of completion or race results from the past 3 years with a qualifying age graded score.
Yeah, so why should you pay the same as everybody else if you are healthier than the average population? Go over to healthiq.com/MTA to see if you qualify and learn more. You can also get a free rate quote. Once again, that's healthiq.com/MTA. All right, well now it's time for this episode's quick tip. Angie's favorite segment of the podcast, the quick tip. She spends hours every day just thinking about what she can feature next. She's full of tips, full of wit and wisdom and meritorious deeds.
And you are full of BS and sarcasm.
So this is a question that we get a lot, or probably I should say you get as a running coach, knowing when to cut back, when to take an extra rest day during training. How do you know?
Yeah, we definitely get this question probably several times a week, either through email or through our private Facebook group where we answer member questions. And it really can sometimes be hard to tell the difference between physically needing a break and just feeling lazy. Even as a person who loves to exercise, personally, there are some days when I really have to figure out if my lack of motivation is due to a genuine reason or not. So, you know, every single day I don't necessarily feel like training.
So really, this is about how to listen to your body, because we say that all the time, but what does that actually mean?
Right. And with flu season here, there are many people who are struggling with sickness. So I kind of developed a few questions to ask yourself to figure out what your body needs you to do.
All right.
The first one is, are your muscles really sore or are you feeling achy at all? So if your muscles are feeling really sore from a previous hard workout, or if you're feeling really achy, this could be a sign that you're not getting enough recovery time, or that you're possibly getting sick and an extra rest day may be just what you need. So that may be the time to skip a hard workout and either take an extra rest day or maybe do some gentle yoga or something really light and low impact. Because really, your body makes those gains when you rest. And so if your muscles are chronically sore, you're not getting the recovery time that you need. The second question is, are you injured? Or are you dealing with discomfort that hurts while you're running or afterward? This could be an early sign of injury, and giving yourself an extra rest day to help decrease inflammation may be a wise choice. If the issue doesn't respond to this extra rest time, then you need to consult a medical professional and get some advice so that it doesn't turn into a full-blown injury. The third question, did you get less than 6 hours of sleep? Everyone knows, if they've listened to this podcast long enough, that I am a sleep fanatic. If you got a really low amount of sleep the night before, then getting extra sleep is probably more important than your workout, and it may be wise to take an extra day off or just do some easy, low-impact cross training or stretching and mobility work. So I know you probably won't hear this in all like the hardcore advice that people get, you know, just go harder, go harder, go harder. But if you're not getting the sleep you need, then you're not going to get the results that you want out of your training. Chronically getting very little sleep can lead to unpleasant things like lack of recovery, injury, increased stress levels, definitely increased stress levels if I don't get my sleep, lack of progress in your training, and weight gain. So I know that there's going to be a few people out there who are able to thrive on less than 6 hours of sleep, but that's a very small number of people. So the rest of us need approximately 7 to 8 hours of sleep a night. Some people more, especially if they run a lot of miles or if they train really heavy. So, you know, people feel like they can train themselves and need less sleep, but really the body just learns how to function at a suboptimal level.
Yeah.
So it's not healthy for your body in the long term. There can be a lot of negative health consequences. So the bottom line is, get as much sleep as you can.
We actually dedicated a whole episode to sleep. It was called the sleep episode. You folks can probably still find it in the podcast feed, because we always keep 50 shows. The latest 50 in the feed. We had a Harvard-trained sleep expert on the podcast to answer questions and talk about the science behind sleep and performance.
One of my favorite episodes, just because I love talking about sleep. So the fourth question to ask yourself is, have you been sick? If yes, you definitely want to take an extra rest day or maybe an extra 5 rest days, depending on how bad it is. It's been a really tough flu season, as many people know, and there's been a lot of respiratory issues going around as well. And we've heard from a lot of runners lately who've been struggling with sickness in the middle of their training, and it can be really very frustrating to feel like you're getting off track and possibly losing fitness. But if your symptoms are below the neck or you're dealing with a fever or body aches, then strenuous exercise can actually delay your healing. So if you've been sick, it's wise to focus on rest and recovery. And then when your energy levels start to normalize, you can start back slowly with your training plan. In most cases, there's plenty of time to pick back up and get back on track with your training plan, but you shouldn't train hard until you're fully recovered. Now, if your race is coming up quickly, then it's more beneficial to be a bit undertrained but healthy rather than to try to continue training through your sickness and just prolong the whole cycle.
This is golden. This could be a whole quick tip by itself, because we've been asked lots of times about people who've had to miss a week of training and, you know, is that going to do them in? Is that going to derail their goals? What if it's the last week or two before the marathon? You know, people really get stressed out about that.
That's right. Yeah. So, you know, don't try to just plow through when you're miserably sick, and don't try to make up lost weeks of training. Just pick back up where you left off. In some cases, if it's been an extended illness, you know, it may be wise to drop down to a shorter distance or to defer the race to another year if you don't feel confident going into it. But, you know, really make the wise choice and do what's best for your long-term health in this situation.
You can miss a week and still be ready on race day.
That's right. And you can also use your recovery time when you're not really following a regimented training plan as an opportunity to spot train any weak areas. You know, maybe focus on your mobility or hip stretching. Or there's a lot of areas like foam rolling that we neglect. And so maybe you can't be out there running or doing, you know, tough weightlifting, but there's a few things that you could do to let your body rest and also work on any tight or weak areas. And then, you know, very slowly progress back into running. I've seen many people who haven't been back to normal training for 2 to 3 weeks after being sick. So once your energy levels and your eating begin to improve, you can start with walking and then light yoga or strength training. And if that feels good, if you're having enough energy, then you can progress to easy runs and more normal cross training.
Right on.
And the fifth thing to do is to check your mental chatter. If you're feeling physically fine and you know you should get out there for a run, then you probably should. If you've boiled down your lack of motivation to laziness, then promise yourself you'll just get out there for 1 mile or whatever distance seems reasonable to you. At that point, you'll probably be more willing to continue. It's usually always hardest to get out the door. And if you do that, you'll probably be able to do the whole distance.
That's right. The hardest part is just getting out the door into the cold weather and getting that first mile done.
I can only think of maybe like one instance in all my years of a runner that I have actually gotten out there and then like turned around before a mile was over. You know, usually I end up finishing the whole distance that I planned. So if you're genuinely sick, your body will let you know and listen to it. But, you know, if you've just boiled it down to not feeling motivated, or for us women, if it's that time of the month and you're just kind of feeling blah, maybe getting out there for some exercise is the best thing you can do for yourself.
And go back to your tendency and think about what's the best hack for the type of person you are. If you're an obliger, then, you know,
meet a friend.
Exactly. Set a running date with someone else and meet up at the park. Put yourself on the hook to be there. If you're a rebel like me, then get on Instagram. And like, there's some ultra guys that I follow that are always posting these epic pictures running across mountains and through the Costa Rican jungles and stuff. And I'm like, man, that is the life. I mean, adventure, freedom, and that's the sort of spirit that I want to imbibe too. So connecting with like what I want to be about motivates me to run. Do I want to be the kind of guy who's like overweight and sitting behind a desk? Or do I want to be the kind of guy who is running on the trails, jumping over rocks and fording through streams?
That's right. And if you're a questioner and you've gone through this list of questions that we've been talking about, and you've convinced yourself that you're not sick, then, you know, you've probably already gotten up the motivation to get out there on your own. And of course, upholders often have to hold themselves back sometimes from not hurting themselves when either they're sick or injured. So they have different problems.
Yeah, it could be stressful to see that you have a run, maybe you have a 6 mile run planned, but you're sick and it just pains you to miss that run because it's on the plan.
That's right.
It's called for.
So in that sense, you have to use higher level reasoning and realize that if you want to be a strong runner who fulfills the rest of the training plan, you're going to have to take this necessary time off in order to be able to run your best race possible.
Okay, so there you go, folks. How to know if you should take an extra rest day. Angie, can you really quick just repeat the 5 questions/points?
That's right. Number one is, are your muscles really sore or are you feeling achy? Number two, are you injured? Number three, did you get less than 6 hours of sleep? Number four, have you been sick? And of course, number five, check your mental chatter.
All right. Well, that brings us to the end of this episode. Thank you so much for being a listener. We'd love to connect with you online. We have a contact form over on our website. You can send in a comment or question anytime, and we'll do our best to get back to you. We also have a pretty good sized Facebook page. I think we're almost to 15,000 likes. So thank you everyone who likes us. Thank you for liking us.
We just want to be liked. And of course, follow us on Instagram at Marathon Academy. And another great thing you can do for the show is to leave a positive review in iTunes.
Yeah, that's right. Thank you everyone who has left us a 5-star review on iTunes. We do read those and it's very motivating. Just encourages us to keep getting the best guests and digging deep to provide the best content that we can on the podcast. And if you need help taking your training and running to the next level, getting your questions answered, getting perhaps that outer accountability or inspiration as a rebel or solid plan to follow, Be sure to check out Academy membership. We got you covered. We'll help you get to where you want to go in this journey called long distance running. Until next time, folks, keep taking action toward your goals. You have what it takes to run a marathon and change your life. Right on my way.